we go. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. This is your host, Mike Lafferty. And with us today is Dan Abnett, who very graciously stops by about once a year to give us sort of a patina of legitimacy. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
All right, always glad to have you. My co-host today is Jacob Blackman. How you doing, Jacob?
42 years, still no cavities.
Oh, that's right. It's Jacob's birthday today. Happy birthday, Jacob.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
How are you celebrating?
I am doing absolutely nothing. So I have no intents of working today. I'm planning on spending the day relaxing and, you know, hanging out with fine folks like you.
All right, cool. Well, excellent. And for those who aren't aware, Dan Abnett has been writing comics and other novels, other forms of media, screenplays for just a very long time. The incarnation of Guardians of the Galaxy that you're familiar with, that's what Dan wrote. Dan has done a lot of work at Marvel. Most recently, he's been at DC, and right now he's writing, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, Silencer, Aquaman, and Titans are your three big books right now. Is that
correct? Correct, yes, yeah.
All right, cool. What are you enjoying most right now?
I'm enjoying all of it, to be honest. It's extremely enjoyable working on something brand new like Silencer, where you're creating from the ground up, but also to take on legacy characters like Titans and Aquaman. And Aquaman is something I feel particularly proud of because I'm now approaching my 40th issue in a straight run, and we're getting great acclaim, and the book is doing really, really well, and it's a massive and exciting storyline. And we've also managed to get, as a limited series alongside it, we're doing Mira, has her own series, which is sitting alongside Aquaman and is both self-contained and related to Aquaman. So there's a lovely sort of broad scope of things going on.
Okay. Yeah, you've been really knocking out of the park with Aquaman. Honestly, this is the longest I've ever followed an Aquaman series, and I've just been bowled over.
Thank you.
So, now what, I got to confess, I don't know a lot about Silencer. In fact, the only thing I knew about it was about a year ago when you were on, you mentioned it, and I guess it kind of got rescheduled to sort of go into this new launch DC is doing. Can you give us sort of the brief pitch for what Silencer is about?
Silencer is one of the new characters that the DC is creating. I think the idea behind it, generally speaking, was that DC with Rebirth have proven that it can take its classic characters and do exciting, bold things with them and make them as popular as ever. And they also wanted to prove that they could create new things. So, as you say, about a year ago, we were planning these books, and my contribution to the feast at this summit was Silencer, which I've been working on with John Romita Jr., which is obviously a huge treat. Silencer is a sort of an ex-assassin character. She's an operative who's worked in the underworld or underlife, as we call it, for some time, and has retired. And as the series begins, we discover that her lovely, really lovely, normal domestic life that she's been craving for her entire life since she was born is now under threat because problems within the underlife and within Leviathan, the organization she used to work for, are sort of now grabbing people who thought they'd left it all behind. So she is required to sort of gear up again simply to protect herself and her family against this threat from her past. And as Silencer, she's a top-level assassin. She was a fixer, and she has this particular superpower, which is that she can create a zone of silence around her, which allows her to work in a very stealthy way. So this is... The first, I think, two issues are now out. It's very visceral stuff. It's quite funny in places, which offsets how darkly violent the rest of it is. And it's a nice interplay between a very sort of real domestic world and a completely larger-than-life, outrageously crazy comics world that she is in the rest of the time.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of like street-level characters in the DC universe. I mean, there's a few here and there, but the spotlight seems to be on some of the heavy hitters. It's nice to see... Nice to see a different part of the DC.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing for me. Obviously, I'm writing, you know, the Titans and Aquaman, and they are pretty heavy hitters, and they do that sort of big, big, expansive superhero-ish stuff, whereas Silencer is on a much, much smaller scale, but very interesting. And one of the things we decided to do is to build this idea of the underlife, this idea of a sort of an organized criminal world that lies just beneath the surface of the DCU. Not as a brand new thing that suddenly appealed, but something that's always been there, but virtually never. It's never visible. It never intrudes on the rest of the daily life in the DCU, and that's what we're sort of digging into here and discovering the strange rules and traditions and organization of this world and the way it operates.
Any chance we'll see Checkmate checking in now and then?
I can't guarantee definitely that character, but that is exactly the sort of character we're talking about. We're talking about that sort of work, the world of the sort of criminal professional. We have a guest star coming up pretty soon who fits that sort of mode. But yes, I'm constantly looking at all sorts of people who we could say have been working in the underlife for years, and we make that connection.
Okay, cool. Well, if you don't mind, I posted on Reddit on the subreddits for Aquaman and DC Comics that I was going to be talking to you this morning, and I've got a bunch of questions. Are you cool if I read those off to you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
All right, from the Aquaman subreddit, from Reddit user called Let's Kill Robots, he says, awesome, two questions. Number one, what do you hope they don't do in the new upcoming Aquaman film?
Screw it up.
Okay.
I would say. I don't know. I think it's interesting. I think the cinematic look of Aquaman is pretty strong, actually. He's got a great screen presence. I just want to make sure that I hope the movie captures all the fun that can be had in the Aquaman comic, the stuff that I've been trying to do, and certainly before me that Geoff Johns was doing, that sort of a sense of a reality to the hero without becoming too silly, really. I mean, he's always labored from the fact that people haven't taken him seriously, and both as an in-universe character and as a character full stop, and it's something I've really worked very hard to try and change, so I hope that the film supports that, and I can't believe it wouldn't, or it certainly wouldn't try to do that.
You ever heard about on the set of Where the Buffalo Roam, Hunter S. Thompson locked Bill Murray in a trailer with a gun to explain to him how to play him?
I didn't, but yeah, I could see that happening.
you ever considered doing that with Jason Momoa?
I think I'd come off worse, though, even if I had a gun.
Okay, fair enough. And Let's Kill Robots' second question is a bit of a tangent, but I'd love to hear his take on his goal with the current Mera run. What would he like to have accomplished once he's done writing the series?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. Mera is one of my favorite characters, and I think she's possibly the most underrated character in the DCU. She fully deserves to be one of the most important characters there. That's one of the reasons that actually in the run-up to this series that I managed to sort of get her a membership of the Justice League and things like that, because she deserves to be there. I think she's a really interesting character, and I think the dynamic between her and Aquaman is also very unusual in comics. To have that kind of idea of a very powerful, strong, loyal relationship is very, very unusual. And she's such a prominent character that in some respects, when you're writing Aquaman, there's a danger that he becomes a supporting character to Mera because she's so interesting. I've tried not to let that happen, but it seems a shame that after however many decades that Mira's been around as a character, and I think it's probably five, that she has never had her own titled book. So that's one of the things we wanted to do. We put her front and center and look, this, you know, so this is not, you know, a cool supporting character. This is a great character in her own right. So what I've attempted to do with these six issues is to tell a story that really examines who she is and why she's an interesting character to read about, particularly in the context of the current massive, massive events that are going on in the Aquaman book, which is obviously she's part of and has played a very important part of. But not to tie it in so that it becomes a sort of a sidekick book or a supporting character book to the main book. Her story in this six issues is very much her own. It's absolutely vitally important to the big picture, but it is of itself self-contained. You know, you can read that and not know anything about anything else that's going on, because it's a story about her and what she seeks to achieve. And I hope by the end of it, people who don't know the character, people who do know the character, I hope will go, that was a great story for her. It's so great to see her showcased. And people who don't know the character go, wow, I need to read more about her. She's fantastic. Really compelled by the way she is such an interesting mix blend of things. So I guess that's my intention is to give her a moment to show how good she is without needing Aquaman to be there to show that she's part of a different title.
Okay. Another question from a fellow. He's being a little cheeky here. Supermac is the username on Reddit, and he says, and you probably get this question at conventions, I'm guessing. Any plans to bring back the harpoon or the water hand?
not at the moment, no. I think they're both interesting things to do. But genuinely interesting things to do, and I think they were both handled pretty well when they were sort of current in the book. However, to me, they were also attempts to try and make Aquaman himself more interesting by sort of giving him a gimmick, you know, sort of something that goes, yes, you can tell he's Aquaman because he's got a hook like a pirate, or you can tell he's Aquaman because one of his hands is made of water. And to me, Aquaman doesn't need that. Aquaman is a really cool, interesting character anyway. So that's really the strength that I've been playing up in, particularly in the last sort of, well, since issue 25, really, in this big, big storyline, to play up his role as a hero, his connection to the culture of Atlantis. I digress for a moment and say that it was very interesting. When I started writing Aquaman, I was advised, I think wisely, I was advised by DC and by the editors who'd worked on the character for a while, that Aquaman as a character works best when he's placed in the real world, in sort of, you know, sort of dry land situations, and that Atlantis set stories don't work as well, and that I should do a limited number of Atlantis set stories because they didn't, you know, sort of they didn't seem to catch people's imaginations as much. Weirdly, we got to issue 25 and decided to embark upon a major Atlantis set story where we've been ever since, and it's been the most popular part of the run so far. People are loving it, and I think it's because we've gone really deep into that sort of what might be glibly referred to as sort of Game of Thrones territory of you know, it's a massive, complex, slightly alien fantasy society. I've built up the cast of supporting characters. There's lots of intrigue and double cross and all sorts of things going on, and people seem to really, really like that. I basically said that rather than Aquaman being a superhero in a surface city in exactly the same way that everybody else is, he should operate almost like Batman in Atlantis. We'll make our city the underwater one, and we'll make him the vigilante protecting it. And that really seems to have struck a chord.
Yeah, I think I probably told you before, this is the first time I can remember since the days of Sub Diego, if anyone remembers that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great story. Yeah,
that Aquaman's really had sort of a fleshed out environment the way Batman or Superman does.
Yeah, and it's daft because it's always been there. I mean, Atlantis has always been there. It's waiting to be sort of explored. Once we got past the idea that it's a sort of, you know, like sort of little fake castle at the bottom of a fish tank, and you start to think of it as a proper nation with cultures and traditions and politics and stuff like that, it suddenly becomes really, really interesting. So it's weirdly, without leaving the real world behind, Aquaman has for a while now been a very sort of fantasy superhero story, and that seems to have worked extremely well. I think it helps that we've had some great artists, really superb artists, working on it. And like I said, we've Aquaman does not have a massive supporting cast or a massive rogues gallery, so I've increased both of those, and we've got a lot of characters moving in and out in a really interesting way. And some of them, I think, are very memorable, and they've been rendered beautifully.
Jacob, did you have a question?
Actually, I was going to commend him on a lot of things he was just talking about, because Marvel and Wakanda, for a lot of years, Black Panther was pretty much the only character that people knew about from Wakanda. Yeah. And it's supposed to be this vast, technologically advanced civilization. And all you ever knew is that that's where Black Panther came from. And that's his background. They never went into his royal family or the other people who live there, you know, but a lot like that, that's where I've really been enjoying this arc of Aquaman, because you've gone into all the intrigues of Atlantis. They're not just kind of there as his background. It's not always just I want the throne. No, I want the throne. You know, we have Game of Thrones for that. And with all the supporting characters you brought in, and the different different factions who have the ways they want to run Atlantis, but realizing that no longer works in the world that it is, with all the superheroes showing up, these things have to change. Arthur realizing that he can't be king anymore if he's going to be Aquaman.
Yeah.
He has to choose one or the other.
Yeah.
And he's deciding he's deciding he wants to be a hero instead. And I really like that story where he passes that on to Mara.
Yeah.
He thinks she's doing a better job.
She's doing a better job. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're appreciating that. I think it's really interesting, obviously, because I've been working on this for a while now. I was aware that Black Panther was coming along, and it's been really interesting to me in the last few weeks, I suppose, as the films opened and been so successful, that one of the things that everybody's gone to and said, it's Don McGregor's run when he actually opened up the idea of Wakanda and developed those ideas there and showed that texture and that context that really brought the characters to life, and that's really what they've dealt with in the film. And I think that's interesting that the sort of, as it were, independently, I was sort of ending up doing the same sort of thing with Aquaman, because I think it's too easy to take a character and say, what, you know, I want him to be like Batman or like Superman, and therefore go and try and borrow their stuff, you know, sort of literally put Aquaman in Gotham City or put him in Metropolis or do all those sort of things with it, where he's got this thing that's inherent in his character that's always been there, which is this incredibly rich background that doesn't get that sort of exploitation and development. And so once we realized that could work, everything else really followed on from there. It's going to be interesting. We're sort of approaching the climax of this major storyline, and I'm now seriously thinking about what I should do next, whether I should go, right, we've done that, now we need to do something different and sort of really change the game, or whether saying, no, this sort of works. I can't keep telling this story, but clearly this is a world where there are lots of other stories to tell, and that will be decisions that will get made in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned artists there, because the next question from user, I love usernames on Reddit, Gilligan4 was asking, has transitioning between three artists in the past year been difficult for Aquaman? What was the process of working with Sedgwick like? And I hope I said his name right.
Yes. Yeah, well, fantastic. It's interesting. 25, the issue he took over, was the first of the monthly schedule. Before that, we were on an issue every 2 weeks. So we had the rotating art team simply because no artist could keep up with that pressure of producing 40 pages a month. So we got an awful lot of issues under our belt. Then Steph came along and went on, and we had a month per issue, and he was just amazing. I can't believe he produces the work he produces as fast as he does, and we got those six amazing issues. But the artists who followed on from him have also been extraordinary. I had this real sort of dread in my heart that once those six issues were over, the quality of the book would drop away and people would lose interest in the storyline. But if anything, they're sort of coming in greater and greater numbers because we've managed to keep that going. So the bi-monthly schedule, or sort of every 2 week schedule, depending on what you mean by bi-monthly, bi-weekly thing that we were doing for the first 25 issues was a killer, and it was a killer for all the Rebirth books. And I think we were the only book of all of DC's titles that just kept the same three artists in rotation. We didn't need to go to fillers, so they deserve enormous praise for keeping that schedule up. Now we're onto a slightly different feeling, and we've had some really interesting things happen. And just that visual opening up of Atlantis in terms of its architecture and its geography and its inhabitants, now seeing that lens through several different artists bringing their imaginations to it, all in keeping and all fitting together, but building up this enormous tapestry. I think it's quite useful that the Stefan stuff was amazing, but it's really good that he wasn't the only guy who could draw it, because there's a sense there that it only works when that happens, and otherwise it's not interesting. We've proven that it's an interesting environment, like Wakanda, where you can get different artists to draw it and it's still compelling.
Well, as as much as I often praise Stefan, the reason he's able to do things really quickly, as an artist speaking, look at his line work. Yeah. It's really slapdash. But he covers it up with those amazing colors.
Yeah, well, it's color and it's rendering. Yeah, I wouldn't call it slapdash, to be honest. I would say that he has a simplicity of line work because he knows
that he's bringing
a rendering to the art that other artists would need a great deal more line work to deal with. But no, I take your point. And every artist has their style. Sometimes it is amazing to me that an artist like him or some of the other greats who can suggest so much with a simple line, and others, you know, the page is bursting with wonder simply because of the detail they put in. And it really is to do with personal styles. But Stefan knows that what he's producing is what in the UK we would call, effectively in the old days, called fully painted artwork. He's producing something that is not just coloured art. It is art where the colour is part of the art in as much as it is creating everything, atmosphere, costume, everything.
Absolutely.
That is astonishing. Even doing that, to me, is astonishing to produce 20 pages of that in a month, and I would quite often be following closely on his coattails because I'd be getting his, for want of a better word, pencils to dialogue with as he was then producing the rendered art, and there was sort of nothing missing. I'd look at these pages and go, they're extraordinary, they're brilliant, they're fantastic, and I would never in any doubt what was going on. And then the finished page would arrive and it would blow your socks off because you go, I can't believe he's put so much into it since I looked at it and thought it was fine.
No, his color work is unbelievable. I am always in awe of the work I see coming from him.
Yeah, and he's very, very good at character too. I think his personalities of the characters, so that he's one of those few artists who can simply have a couple of people standing around talking and it'd be fascinating, whereas, you know, a lot of people would need to sort of busy that up in some sort of way to make it really work. And I think that's really helped with the intrigue angle in the story, that you can actually have those sort of conspiratorial conversations and they not be dull pages and wasted panels, that you actually get into the character of people.
Yeah. Have you seen Stefan's just joke panels that he does for fun?
I have, yes.
Of DC characters, like yes. Green Lantern bringing a piece of kryptonite to Kal-El.
Yes, yes. He's got a great sense of humor. I think that great sense of humor it informs a lot of what he does anyway. I think there is a sort of there is often an impishness to some of the expressions. Some of the things he's done, particularly with Dolphin, of course, who's a character who doesn't speak. So her entire speech has to come through her facial expression. I think he's been fantastic with her. Amazing things.
I've got a question now from, love these usernames, Nomadic Jaguar 64T is asking, is it scary or fun creating a brand new character like the Silencer? Was the Silencer brand new? Wasn't there some history there?
No, there was no history at all. Silencer was brand new. It is always scary to create something new, and because you're going in there without any kind of life support or kind of anything else. In other areas, not necessarily DC, but when I've written creator own books or when I'm writing novels or something where I'm fully originating, the creative freedom is so thrilling. But you also know that you're sort of going in cold, that people don't know what this is. They don't know what it's connected to. They don't know what they should think of it. And therefore, the response is going to be much more measured than if you say, hey, I'm writing another issue of something you know very well. And they get very excited about that. With Silencer, of course, we had two huge assets going in there. One is that we were setting it in the DC universe, so at least we had the support network of the DC universe. This wasn't a completely solo book separated from anything that you knew before. And obviously, we had John drawing it, and John is amazing. Now, the idea of the character came to me during the summit discussions, and which John was present at. John and several other artists were present at. It's really to get their sort of lead on what would be interesting to them as artists. And John chose to do it when he heard my pitch. And he said, when he heard me talk about what the character that I thought of and what you could do with it, he was the one who said, "That's the one I want to draw." He got really excited about it. So I had that enormous support of knowing that I was going in there with one of the best artists around, who was imagining stuff and creating some of the ideas, you know, finessing some of the things as we went along, so that we, you know, we developed it together and worked out things like how our costume worked and that kind of stuff. So that was thrilling. It was so thrilling that I forgot to be scared. But deep down inside, there was part of me going, "This is terrifying." Is to produce something that you're dropping into this enormous ocean of brilliant DC characters and hoping that it's going to, you know, survive. And that is always the worry with something like that.
Okay. Got a bunch more questions. I'm going to have to, oh geez, Grey Ghost has a bullet point response with 7 different questions. We'll save him for last. coming from Shadow Phoenix 22 on the DC Comics subreddit. Dan, what's your favorite story to write on Titans so far?
Goodness me. That's very interesting. There have been particular in moments in the Titans run that I've really enjoyed. I really enjoyed writing the Titans Hunt mini that I brought them back together again just prior to Rebirth. It was sort of a dry run for Rebirth that actually established what we were going to do, because that could delve into their past and indeed their hidden past and lost continuities, which was fantastic. But there have been some really powerful moments in the series so far, but if I was going to pick a story, and I'm going to cheat here slightly, but if I was going to pick a story, it's kind of the meta story of the series so far, which has been now sort of running through again about 20 issues, because we tried to craft a book where it was nice self-contained story, so you get a, you know, 2 or 3 issue arc of this and a 2 or 3 issue arc of that. And then we built up to, for instance, a great crossover with Teen Titans and Deathstroke, which was, you know, a fantastic, fun thing to do. But all the while, it wasn't that I was necessarily building and planning, but I could see that some of these storylines had loose ends and things that necessarily wouldn't go away. And I could start using them to fabricate a sort of spinal cord that ran through the series. So the issues at the moment, where very drastic, catastrophic things are happening to the Titans, really is sort of, you can read it as the arc that it's being presented in, but if you go back, all of that groundwork has been done since day one, and I'm sort of paying off things, sort of side remarks and side ideas that were there all the way through. So actually, I think the story I've enjoyed most is the idea that it is sort of one big story, really, and that's worked without making anybody bored or think, oh god, this is going on forever, or even really be aware that it is one big story, that it's been broken down into discrete chapters that are individual adventures, but have linked together. So the storyline as it grew out of there being some kind of traitor within their ranks and who that could possibly be and what the repercussions of that would be, I think of paying those off have been really, really good. And now we're really dealing with the quite dramatic aftermath of that event.
Okay. Simple and quick question from Rebel Punk 13. Who would win between Aquaman and Namor?
Oh, goodness me. Goodness me.
Wasn't that settled in DC versus Marvel about 15 years ago?
Settled in DC, yeah. Part of me, the 6-year-old comic reader in me would say, well, obviously Namor would win because he's just very aggressive and he is extraordinarily powerful. But I think, and I'm not just saying this because I'm writing Aquaman or I'm writing for DC and all that kind of stuff. I think in the end, Aquaman would have the upper hand. I think he, no pun intended, hook or harpoon or water hand upper hand, he would have the... I think that he would... He has greater... and again, avoiding the pun, I was going to say depth. He has greater dimensions to his character. So the different facets of who he is and what he is, sort of his heroism, his ability, as well as his talents and his power, I think would overcome the sort of single-minded fury of Namor in the end. But then, okay, you know, I would say that.
Let's put it this way. As the writer, Dan, how much is Aquaman able to lift?
What are you doing, Jacob?
Okay.
I'm using vital statistics to prove a point.
Yes. Now, I believe that Namor is class 100, isn't he?
Yes, but class 100 means means potentially over 100 tons.
Yes, exactly. We have seen Aquaman in the current run going toe-to-toe with Superman.
This is true.
And Superman can lift without solar energy empowerment 100,000 tons. Yeah. So,
Aquaman isn't quite there, but he's got enough technique to be able to hold his own against. I don't know. If I was doing it in the old Marvel Handbook way, I would imagine that Aquaman is around the sort of 50 ton level, class 50. But I think he's got connected to that, like I said, a suite of powers and ability and technique that means that he sort of boxes above his weight quite seriously. So I think Namor is definitely stronger than Aquaman, but Aquaman is a lot stronger than people think he is. I think that's an important thing to bear in mind. He's often thought of as much less powerful than he actually is.
All right, moving on. Got a question.
Please, before we descend into that too deeply.
End the nerd rage.
What about Wolverine versus Batman? No, moving on. At McGeth asks, first opens with a compliment. Your Aquaman run is consistently my favorite book. I love how you managed to incorporate new and old ideas into this incredible epic. My question is, where do you envision Arthur in the wider DCU and in an ideological sense? What role do you think he should play in the wider community of superheroes?
Well, I think it's the role we've already seen him play, but in a broader sense, as a member of the Justice League, I think he is. I think he is one of the, and this is a really obvious thing to say, but I think he's one of the most ecologically minded of them all. He cares about the planet as a whole, and its health and its survival on a kind of natural level. And I think that sort of puts him very much alongside people like Wonder Woman in terms of their sort of holistic care for the planet and the way that mankind may or may not be ruining it. But I also think that his experience as an outsider makes him very similar to Superman and Wonder Woman, but his experience as a member of a nation and indeed as the leader of a nation, I think, means that he has a greater grasp of the responsibility of those in power or those with power to look after those who don't have that. And I know that is shared by all heroes to a greater extent, and certainly Superman thinks about that all the time. But Aquaman has sort of seen it in action from the point of view of actually being placed in that position of being saying, right, you're king, look after these people. And I think that's a very different way of having to deal with it than, say, Superman going, well, this is my adopted planet and I will look after these people. I think it's a much more sort of intensely sort of ground up approach to the way you need to care for people, citizens, populations, and their interests, and actually listen to them and to understand that sometimes what you consider to be the right thing, to necessarily the right thing to do or the right thing by them. I think, in other words, I'm saying he's possibly the most politically savvy of all of the Justice League. I think that is something that he can use very effectively in the DCU and as a member of that team.
Okay, cool. Question from username Astounded. Again, opens the compliments, saying you've done a fantastic job adding the DC tapestry. And with Underworld, you introduced the concept of mutates underwater, which feels like an idea filled with massive potential. It's almost like the X-Men underwater. Hey, it's such a great addition. Can you talk about that? And do you have any further plans to develop or expand on that concept?
Yeah, I absolutely do. It seemed to me a shame that we had an underwater city, an underwater civilization, which did not have any sort of amphibious creatures in it. To me, Atlantis is as wild and crazy as something that you might find in Star Wars. And I thought it was a shame that we couldn't reflect that visually for a start by having a greater number of looks for the sentient creatures that live within Atlantis. And that was why we started to develop the idea of there being these things, we call them sea-changed, where it's Atlanteans who have lived in the ocean for so long that they have, as it were, succumbed to the environment of the sea and have begun to develop much more than just, you know, a set of gills Patrick Duffy style, but, you know, actually sort of, you know, changing into sort of crab-like forms or squid-like forms, this kind of stuff. And they're considered to be a bit of an underclass in the city, although that is part of the storyline that's going on at the moment. And yes, I can see huge, huge further development for that idea. I think it's appropriate and visually much more distinctive for Aquaman to lead or be part of a nation that is filled with a variety of people who are you know, so visually varied and reflect the wonder of the natural world underwater.
And that was a nice callback you worked into Man from Atlantis.
Thank you.
Got a few more questions if you got the time.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. From the real Cinco on the DC Comics Reddit. First off, I want to thank Dan for working so hard and pouring so much love and effort into Aquaman. My favorite ongoing book. It's encouraged me to venture in Aquaman's history, making him my favorite character. Cool. How do you see Arthur at his essence?
Arthur is his essence. I think he is. People say, well, he's the sea superhero. You know, associating with him the ocean and that kind of stuff. But to me, actually, the thing that sums up the essence of Arthur Curry is the lighthouse in Amnesty Bay. That is to say that Arthur is not, you know, he's half surface born and half Atlantean, and, you know, the divided between two worlds and all yada yada, all of that sort of stuff. To me, what symbolizes him most is the coastline itself. It's the place where the ocean and the land meet. It's where those two civilizations meet, those two natural environments meet. It's all of those sorts of things. And he is, as it were, a personification of the lighthouse that looks out over that line and protects both sides of it. You know, he will stop the sea from harming the land, but he'll also stop the land from harming the sea. So to me, his essence is that sort of that liminal being who stands upon the threshold between these two worlds. And of course, he is you know, associated with the ocean predominantly. But I think that's why, to me, he's always got that global remit. The ocean is 2/3 of the globe. You know, he is concerned with the entire planet. He just happens to have water-based powers, and I think that is it. He is this sort of sentinel on the margin between different things that can be sometimes inadvertently hostile to each other, but otherwise can live in harmony.
Okay, cool. Moving on from. You know, you could just write a short story with story prompts coming from Reddit names. From Zombombi 613. Oh man, well, I don't read Aquaman. I've been enjoying Titans. I love the work you did with the Titans Hunt miniseries. By far my favorite that I've read. I loved your reimagining of old Teen Titans villains such as Mad Mod and Ding Dong Daddy. It's my understanding the Titans Hunt was originally supposed to run for 12 issues, but was shortened to 8. What kind of ideas did you have to drop? Was there anything you wanted to explore within the miniseries that you were unable to?
That's an interesting. Yeah, that is true. It was originally commissioned. I started writing it, and I was asked by Dan DiDio and the editorial team there to write it and to do with it the things that I was doing. That is to say, to take the Titans back to their pre Perez Wolfman incarnation, back to the original '60s Nick Cardy versions, the team lineup there, and to sort of gently find a way of allowing for all that pre New 52 continuity to have actually existed, and to find a way of explaining why it wasn't publicly known and that kind of stuff. So I was doing that, and I was going to do that over 12 issues, and I didn't know that Rebirth was happening. I think I presume at that point they were planning it. I obviously was lower down the information order and therefore hadn't been told about it yet, so it was a big secret in DC high command. But in some respects, Titans Hunt was a tester for the concept of the way that Rebirth would work. The idea of taking both of the continuities and blending them together in a way that was satisfactory. And the very fact that it was working successfully on the page in Titans Hunt and also to the readers, I think was considered to be a dry run for Rebirth by you know, the DC editorial. This was worth doing because look, it's working with Titans. So I was then asked if I was told about Rebirth, and they said, "But what we're going to do actually is going to stop you short, but then launch with Rebirth a new Titans book that you'll be writing." So actually, a lot of the things that I would have done in what would have been the second half of that series then went into Titans itself as part of the ongoing book. And the key thing was the return of Wally West. That was originally going to be part of Titans Hunt. that would have been one of the big moments in the sort of final act of the series, with him returning to help them battle Mr. Twister. And obviously that was something that then moved sideways into Jeff's Rebirth one-shot and became the sort of the defining iconic moment of what Rebirth was all about, which pleased me enormously because obviously it raised the spotlight on the Titans enormously as being right there at ground zero of the event. And therefore I could then pick up from those things, bring Wally into the team and run with it from then. Again, no pun intended. God, it's a pun afternoon today. So that's what I was doing. We didn't lose something massive it's a shame that it never got seen. I was slightly more economical with the space I had and then obviously was able to use things properly post Rebirth.
Okay, cool. Got another question from user Varden10. What do you see the relationship between Aquaman and the other members of the JLA? He's been on the on and off for decades, but he's always been something of a loner for the last few years. Is there anyone on the team you see as being a particularly good friend for Arthur?
Yeah, I do. I think because of the types of stories you end up having to tell with Aquaman, it does tend to separate him from the Justice League quite a lot. And that increases the impression of him being a loner. But I think that's, you know, he's not interacting with the Justice League a lot at the moment in my book, obviously, because he's involved in the Civil War in Atlantis. But I think he is absolutely a core part of the League. And I think that he's close relationship, I think he has several of them. I think his closest sort of kindred spirit is Wonder Woman, I think, because they understand each other very much because they come from sort of similar places in terms of civilizations that are outside the remit of the modern world. I think he has a very, very strong friendship with Superman, even though they clash from time to time, because I think they both share a sort of the same sort of noble spirit and recognize that in each other and admire each other. I've tried to show on various occasions earlier on in my run that they are sort of pretty close and they can depend upon each other. Superman plays a very important part in Aquaman ending the war with the United States in earlier in my run. And actually the person that he sort of would seem to be most antagonistic to is Batman, except I think the two of them have the most amazingly grudging relationship. Aquaman doesn't really approve of Batman's techniques, but admires him because he's so extraordinary. And Batman considers Aquaman to be one of the greatest potential threats to the DC universe because of the sheer power of Atlantis. And therefore admires the fact that Arthur can keep it in check if necessary. And so I think those, you know, he sort of connects very well in very different ways with the Trinity at the core of the Justice League.
Okay, cool. Next question from user First Moonies on the DC Comics subreddit. And you might have addressed this in our previous question about Titans. Question is, what happened to Wally's pacemaker and what was the original story you wanted to tell? From the interviews, you seem to want to write a born-again for the character. Did the plans change? And thanks for your writing.
Well, thank you for thanking me. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. No, we didn't change that massively. I'm trying to think what, if anything, we dropped. I think I would have run the storyline for a little longer if that had been appropriate in the context of the issues. But there was just this extraordinarily good and powerful moment for us to sort of draw a line under that storyline. But in both cases, both in the Teen Titans crossover where that emerged, and in the Donna Troy story where we sort of resolved it, they were both very important moments to show that something really properly important had happened and changed. There was a lasting change to what had occurred. And I don't think necessarily the damage done to Wally in the Rebirth event in the time stream, and indeed in Teen Titans Deathstroke crossover, has gone away completely yet. I think there are things that will haunt his character for quite a long time, as you will see reading both Titans and indeed Flash.
Okay, cool. Question from Wargrifter on the DC Comics subreddit. I love how you present Aquaman and Mira's relationship, and I love the new take on Dolphin. I feel, though, Tula as Aqua Girl has been kind of neglected, although I love the stronger familial bond she has with Arthur and Mira. Garth and Arthur need to interact more. Do you have any stories planned that will expand on the Aqua Kids?
Yes, I do. I mean, the problem there, without going into massive continuity detail, is that Mira and Dolphin and Tula have, over the years, sort of performed the same role in different incarnations of Aquaman, and there is a duplication there. So what I wanted to try and do was to separate them out so they were all very clearly defined characters. Mira is so strong and important, and Tula, I really enjoyed giving her an important sort of royal role as regent in Atlantis before the Civil War began. Tula plays an important role in the Mira miniseries, so her character has not been forgotten and disposed with. And indeed, Garth, who is a member of the Titans, has appeared in Aquaman, assisting Mira again in the Civil War struggle. So I've tried not to forget them. It's difficult to use Garth more than I do in Aquaman because, of course, he is in another book and it just becomes enormously complicated to explain why he's in two places at once. But with Tula, just writing Tula in the Mira miniseries, I've seen new potential for her that are very specific things that we could do with her, i.e. storylines that I couldn't do with Mira or with Dolphin, and therefore we might see some of that in the near future.
Okay, cool. Two more questions, one shorter, one multi-part. First one, shorter question from Dr. T on the comic books, just general comic books subreddit. I love Abnett's work. His name makes pretty much any book a must. His books often contains very large casts with team books like Titans and Guardians expanding throughout their respective runs. Even books like Aquaman, a traditionally solo title, has a large supporting cast. How does he approach balancing the books so all characters get time to shine?
It's tricky, and it is tricky. Of course, it's tricky because you don't want to eclipse and lose any of your crucial characters. That's something I'm thinking about all the time with Titans, is to make sure that everybody gets their moment and we don't lose and forget people. I think it's easier with a book like Aquaman, where actually you start off scratching around trying to find out who you can write stories about and start to build up a cast and then have that cast in motion. I always think of it a bit like a TV show, where you do the first season with a comparatively small cast because you haven't got much budget because the show isn't a success yet. So you play around with those characters, and then the show is a hit and it takes off, and you get a bigger budget for your second season. So you can start making more of the supporting cast and maybe get some more guest stars and maybe add a couple of regular cast members. And then you can expand that way. And everybody, therefore, is kept in a sort of a state of balance with each other, because you know the part they play within that matrix of interconnection. When you're starting off with a team book like Guardians or Titans or something like that, you've got to be on that right from the word go, trying to make sure you balance them out. But to me, I write a solo book with Aquaman and DB Silencer, and that's enormously good fun. But I love what might be regarded as the team dynamic or the group dynamic, whether you're writing a superhero team or whether you're simply writing a book with a large cast, because so many more interesting things can happen. Interactions, surprises, connections between people, that sort of thing. I think that's what makes it work. And it's something that I do all over the place. I clearly enjoy writing character-driven stuff, but we're writing for, even writing for Warhammer, where I write novels and have been writing novels for 20 years. My longest novel series, which is now on its 14th novel, is basically it's a story of soldiers in space. It's a small, you know, it's an infantry unit in a space war, but it's gone so far beyond that, because after 14 novels, we've got hundreds of characters in that unit, and their interactions are so important. So it's almost like a soap opera, and I mean that in a good sense, but it's almost like a soap opera where you know, occasionally action happens, rather than just being, oh, it's the next adventure from these six guys and their guns. And I think that's a really important thing. I think it's a really interesting thing. If you look at great TV, it is the quality and the range and diversity and complexity of the cast that keeps you hooked. So Okay. It's something I'm always drawn to.
I am so glad you mentioned Warhammer, because Grey Ghost, who I mentioned previously, who has the multi-part question, his first question for you was, what was it like going from Warhammer to Aquaman?
Ridiculously easy. I'd been by the time the Warhammer guys recruited me to write for them in the 1990s, dare I say it, I'd already been writing comics for 10 years. So I was well versed in Marvel and DC superheroes. And in fact, I was writing novels, splitting my time between writing novels for Warhammer and Doctor Who and things like that, and writing comics for DC and Marvel and 2000 AD. So it was apart from the fact that usually one's prose and one's superhero, it was just a matter of traveling to a different universe. And I do that on a daily basis. I'm moving between universes on a daily basis. Already today I've visited three, I think, just keeping ahead of the work I'm doing. And actually, there is, particularly with the fantasy world element of Aquaman, there is an awful lot in common with the world-building techniques you need to use in something like Warhammer. So there is similarity there. But also the difference is so refreshing. Warhammer is this really bleak, far future, dark, gothic, horrible thing where you write in one particular mindset, and Aquaman is obviously much more optimistic and heroic. And there is, I think if I was doing either one of those things all the time, I'd be just become completely overwhelmed by that. So to be able to skip between those things, in the last year writing Aquaman, I've also written two Warhammer novels. So I've moved between those things a lot and changed and mixed up the way these things connect. And it is sometimes, you know, if I'm stuck on something, if I can't bring myself to write another moment of Warhammer one day because I've just been at it too long, being able to go away and write Titans or Aquaman or whatever is a huge creative release. And in fact, I'm writing another Warhammer novel right now, which will come out later in the year. And it was pretty much in place. I knew the plot I was writing, but I kind of wanted an extra bit to add to it. And I was thinking about it in the back of my mind, and I was working on it, and nothing was necessarily happening. And I didn't need it right now, but I needed to develop it. And then I actually sat down and I was writing Aquaman. And because my mind was focused on Aquaman, and Aquaman was going really, really well, swimmingly well, he says, just to add another pun in there, because Aquaman was going swimmingly well, suddenly, like a light, I had this light bulb moment where I suddenly, something subconscious, subliminal, the back of my head went, that here's the idea you wanted for that Warhammer. And you could never have had it if you were staring at Warhammer at the time. But because you're thinking about something completely different, then it's come to you and you've got the moment to do that. And the same thing happens both directions all the time. You're working on something and you get an idea for something else, because you're not concentrating on it so hard. So yes, one of the best things that's going to happen in the next Warhammer novel happened whilst I was writing Aquaman, and I'm sure some of the best things that happened in Aquaman have happened whilst I've been writing Warhammer. And it is that interconnecting thing that a creative mind does when it's working properly, which mine doesn't all the time, but there you go.
Well, his follow-up question was how Aquaman might have been impacted by Warhammer, but I think you answered that. So yes. Any plans to expand Arthur's Rogues Gallery?
Yes, absolutely. I think he definitely deserves to have more interesting characters, and actually the storylines in Atlantis have given us an opportunity to begin to do that. So yes, I have several ideas in mind that will I hope bear fruit over the next few issues.
Okay, how will Dark Knight's metal impact Aquaman?
Well, obviously we've been running concurrent with that and playing a very careful game of balancing that out so that they get access to Aquaman when they need it. There is potentially a major repercussion from metal that will happen in Aquaman. And we're just deciding that now, so I can't say anything more about it. But we're just working out how that would work if we do it.
Okay. Next question was a world-building question. I think you've touched on that. But he follows up with, could you envision yourself doing a new version of the Atlantis Chronicles in order to flesh out Arthur's world even further?
I could. I love the Atlantis Chronicles. I think it's high time they produced that in a trade. I don't think I've done it as a trade yet. I have my individual issues. I think it's fantastic. But yeah, I guess I could. I could see that. I think it would be a humongous task, because you'd need to do it from the point of view of everything that I've done and that Jeff and everybody has done before me in this, as it were, current incarnation of Aquaman. But I wouldn't want to lose what was done in the Atlantis Chronicles. So it would be a bit like Titans Hunt, is trying to find a way of interconnecting the old lore and mythology, some of which is now slightly contradicted, and the new. But I'm sure it could be done, and I think it would be a lovely thing to do.
Okay. His next question is, what would your readers take away from when they look at your Aquaman? I'm thinking that kind of fits in with your JLA question about the role he plays there, isn't it?
I really do think it is that. I don't think any writer who has written Aquaman over the years has ever sat down and go, well, I'm writing this because it's fun and he's a silly character. I think we've all tried to take him seriously. And some writers, Peter David is a very good example, have done a superb job doing that. But I really think the idea of my number one manifesto writing it was to say, I want people to take Aquaman seriously as not a joke superhero and not the not sort of the gag version of a superhero, but as a worthy member of the Justice League and one that the others admire and one that the DC world admires as a very important character. And certainly we seem to be getting there. I think the fact that there is there's a movie coming and that he's being used all over the place in that serious way, I think is a good reflection of that.
Okay. Any updates on the Rise of the Seven Seas plotline you and Geoff Johns are collaborating on?
Not yet, because Jeff's been a little bit busy with certain things, but that has not disappeared off the radar.
Okay. Any chance we get to see more of the Seven Kingdoms this year?
Provisionally, yes.
Final question from Grey Ghost T. Do you have any unannounced upcoming projects at DC Comics you can tell us about? I see a Warner Brothers ninja standing right behind you there in the darkness of your writing studio, so I'm guessing the answer is no.
I was going to split that answer into two. One is yes, I do, and B, no, I can't mention them.
Okay, that's what I figured. Well, Dan, that is all the questions I have. I really, really appreciate your time. I know you're a very busy man. Jacob, did you have any questions or closing thoughts before we wrap things up?
Pretty much just as a follow-up for what you said earlier, I would love to see a story that really tackles the political implications that Atlantis and Themyscira have with something, you know, Aquaman and Wonder Woman related.
That's a very fine thought. Thank you.
Well, hey, Dan, any closing thoughts or final statements before we wrap things up?
Well, I'd like to thank you guys for talking to me and listening to my relentless ramblings and appalling puns, most of which were inadvertent. And also to thank everybody who's shown an interest.
You've never met Owen Stevens. You know nothing of appalling puns.
I also want to thank everybody who took the time to send in some questions. It's lovely to realize that what I'm writing is it matters enough to people to want to ask questions about it. And I hope I've answered the questions well enough for them.
It's always a pleasure, Dan. Thank you so much for stopping by. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in. And we will catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.